Sponsorship of the KQED live audio stream comes from Stanford Continuing Studies. This winter, join Stanford historians James Sheehan and David Kennedy for the Cold War and its legacies, exploring the global impact of this pivotal era. Learn more at continuingstudies.stanford.edu.
You're listening to Radio Lab.
Radio Lab.
From
WNYC.
See?
Hey, this is Radio Lab. I'm Molly Webster.
Hi. I feel like I haven't seen you since like last summer.
I'm sitting in for Lulu and Latif today.
Oh, God, since we were in Michigan.
Yeah.
With our contributing editor, Heather Radke.
I think that's right.
All right, Heather.
All right.
I'm going to assume you have a story to tell us.
That's right.
That's why we're here.
I have something to tell
you.
So a little while back, I had a conversation with one of Radiolab's favorite science writers.
I'm Lucy Cook. I'm the author of Bitch on the Female of the Species and, I've got a background in zoology.
All right, Lucy.
We do love Lucy.
Yeah. She's like this globe-trotting tracker of amazing animal stories. She's been to Panama to meet stoned dwarf sloths. She went to Sweden to track drunken moose.
All right.
And then a little while back, while she was working on her latest book,
I was delighted to fly to Seattle and meet this population of orcas.
She got wind of a pretty amazing discovery in killer whales.
Yeah, this felt like a really, really important story and one that I found inspirational.
It was a discovery that directly speaks to something that lots of humans are actually going to have to contend with at some point in their lives, including Lucy herself and me and you.
Me.
You, Molly.
Okay. So, yeah.
So, Lucy hopped on a plane.
Flew to Seattle.
And then to get to the patch of the ocean north of Seattle where the whales actually live.
You get a seaplane. You get to feel like you're in a 1970s, you know, adventure TV series. That's how everybody traveled in the 1970s, was by seaplane to go and deal with emergencies, you know.
But the actual reason Lucy was there was to get on a boat with a woman named Deborah Giles.
So my name's Deborah Giles, Dr. Deborah Giles, but I just go by my last name, Giles.
Yeah, I'd written to her offering up my services to join her on her research boat because I'd heard that she went out every day chasing orcas, trying to catch their poo in a net.
That's what I do.
Okay.
Yeah, my main job is poop collection.
And the reason why is because, as she'll tell you, poop is a gold mine.
Yeah, absolutely.
Apparently you can learn a lot about whales by looking at their poop.
Everything you can imagine. Anything that you can get from a blood sample, you can analyze through the feces.
Hormones, microbes, environmental chemicals.
Yes. So
what they do is they go out in the boat until they spot this group of killer whales. And then
you do what's called a distant poop follow.
Oh.
And I believe that is a scientific term. You form a little polite distance back.
Yeah, everyone needs some privacy.
Exactly. You don't want to overcrowd them.
And at some point, one of Giles' assistants,
a non-human research assistant.
Oh.
Eba the dog, the former street dog from Sacramento,
will pick up the scent.
She'll go to the front of the boat,
put her snout in the air,
stand up on the bow,
and then lead them to it.
Does the whale poop float at the surface?
Yes.
We're not talking a solid turd by any means. It's more of a
thick pancake batter.
And then they just lean over the side of the boat with this plastic lab vial on the end of a stick.
And gently break the surface of the water.
And scoop up the poop.
Okay.
So the reason Lucy went to visit Giles and these whales is because the scientists who study them had noticed something odd.
There comes a time when we don't see the females in this population giving birth.
When they got to be around like 40 or so, the female whales just stopped having babies, even though they lived to be 70, 80, even like 100 years old. So
these females were living this long stretch of their life without having any new calves.
But first the scientists thought they were having miscarriages maybe, or there was some kind of pollutant in the water or something that was causing these older females to stop having babies. But in 2017, Giles and this colleague of hers, Sam Wasser, published a poop analysis that confirmed a very different hypothesis that people had been considering for a couple of decades. They wrote, and I quote here, the females in the population have undergone reproductive senescence.
Oh, senescence.
Yeah, which was like not a word I knew, but but maybe you know it. I don't know.
Well,
it's like a fancy way of saying that at a certain age, the reproductive system of these whales started to physiologically shut down.
Hmm.
And along with a lot of other observations about the whales and autopsies of beached whales, they were able to, like, confirm that these whales were going through menopause.
Okay.
That's my big reveal, Molly.
I guess I maybe would have expected them to go through menopause.
You're not surprised. You're not surprised.
I don't know. I'm like,
well, you kind of should be surprised because actually, up until they figured this out about the whales, scientists widely believe that menopause was a uniquely human thing.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It was assumed that human females were the only species that went through it.
Out of like 6,000 some species of mammals, they thought we were the only ones.
So we were just, we were just freaks.
And freaks because if you think about it scientifically, menopause is actually very weird.
Like this is this sort of you saying, like, this is weird? Or do you think scientists are like, yo, this is weird?
I mean, they would probably say it a little bit more fancy.
So I'm, I would just come, it is super weird, right? It is super weird.
Okay, so this is a scientist. His name is Kevin.
And I have a long last name. Langergraver. Kevin Langergraver. I'm an associate professor in the School of Human Evolution and Social Change at Arizona State University.
And Kevin says from an evolutionary point of view, no animal should have what he calls
the substantial post-reproductive lifespan.
Substantial post-reproductive lifespan.
Fun phrase.
Yeah.
I asked him if we could say something more fun, and he said no.
No.
Anyway, the point is, it's the living for a long time after you can no longer reproduce. Mm-hmm. That's the weird part.
It shouldn't be, because from the perspective of evolution, right, what evolution favors traits that get more genes into the next generation.
And if you're not having babies, you're not sending your genes into the next generation.
Natural selection takes a, pretty dim view of a loss of fertility, and once you stop breeding, you die. That's the general story.
And is natural selection really that cut and dry, that it's if you're not contributing to the genetic pool, you should be out?
Well, of course, natural selection isn't everything, right? Not every trait you look at in an organism has a functional reason. But, like the vast majority of mammal species, you end up reproducing until you die, then it's still super weird that a few don't.
Like, think about it this way. If there were a human woman who could keep having babies for her whole life until she dies, she would, genetically at least, outcompete the women who can't.
Hmm.
So it sort of seems like there should be some evolutionary genetic reason for the reproductive system to kind of peter out before the human person does.
That is the evolutionary puzzle, right? So it's not.
Now, one of the most common things people say when they hear about this is that in humans, this is kind of like a fluke of modern life.
So the idea was that perhaps human females were living beyond their reproductive shelf life because we were being propped up by regular meals and modern medicine.
So the idea being that in olden times, we used to die around menopause. And so this long post-reproductive life is just because now we live longer than we used to.
Right. But it turns out, actually, that's not the case.
Which part?
All of that is not true. None of that's true.
Okay.
In ancient times, people also lived to be about 70.
Really?
Yeah.
I just thought it was like the only people who did were like royals who were highly attended to.
No, so there's this interesting thing where like we get these average life expectancy numbers.
Mm-hmm.
And the averages take into account the fact that people die before like the age of 5 because they die in childbirth, they die of infant diseases.
Oh, it's like a skewed average.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh.
So if you account for that, you see that many women were in fact living 20, 25 years, 30 years after they could no longer reproduce. So humans have been going through menopause like for the entire history of humans.
And it's a thing, menopause. It's a roller coaster. It's an emotional and physical roller coaster. So,
and back to Lucy, she says that going into menopause for her was pretty brutal.
I mean, hot sweats and furious moods.
And it's pretty brutal for a lot of women. But she also says,
it's icy fingers, but it's anything but icy. Once it's hot fingers got a hold of me.
She did have in the back of her mind this question, which was,
why? Why was I still alive?
That's a question.
Yeah, it's a pretty intense way to put it. But the thing about menopause,
you know, I know it gets a lot of press now and everybody's allowed to talk about it. My mother's generation, no one did.
For such a long time, it's been completely ignored by science, by culture.
Mm-hmm.
And probably partly because of that, I do think a lot of women end up feeling invisible or useless.
You know, you were just sort of irrelevant after your period stopped, you know, and you were kind of this sort of, you know, kind of gray puddle of purposelessness, you know.
Oh, God. So
when I heard that killer whales went through menopause,
it felt like a chance to ask, what is this time in her life for? In a kind of different, more scientific way.
Yeah. So these are really big questions, and there are a number.
So this is a scientist named Darren Croft.
I am professor of animal behavior at the University of Exeter.
He's part of this huge team that's been studying these killer whales for like decades now.
And so there's this incredible rich amount of data on their behavior and their movements.
And so what the scientists watching these whales day in, day out have seen is that
there's a lot of purpose. And we know that now. These females have rich social lives.
Lives that could make sense in like a cold, hard, evolutionary logic kind of way.
Mm.
So, for example, Giles and Darren told us about this one particular female killer whale named
Granny, who's possibly the most famous wild killer whale in the world.
Granny, she was just an astonishing whale who lived to be at least into her late 80s, possibly as old as 105.
And according to Darren and Giles, all the way up to the end,
she had this zest for life.
Yeah, what does that look like?
Socializing, foraging, breaching, tail slapping.
It does sound zesty.
Yeah,
for being old.
Living life.
Yeah. And in particular, the scientists noticed she's actually a killer grandma.
Carried and played with and babysat brand new babies.
Because the way these groups of killer whales usually work is
sons and daughters stay in their mom's household.
So Granny's part of this sort of multi-generational pod.
Yes. Our colleagues capture drone imagery of Granny helping to corral a fish towards her great-grand calf.
When Darren and his colleagues did a study of these killer whales, they found that the whales that had postmenopausal grandmas around, like Granny...
Whales who aren't having babies of their own anymore.
Right.
Okay.
When those ones were still around, the young had higher chances of survival than the whales who had no grandmas, or even had grandmas who were premenopausal. Does that make sense?
So the grandmas who couldn't have babies anymore were more helpful than the grandmas who were still having babies.
Right. And this actually gave like a lot of support to an idea that people have been thinking about in terms of humans actually for a while.
The grandmother hypothesis.
I feel like I hear a lot about the grandmother hypothesis, but I'm not even sure I know how it works.
Yeah, right. But it's basically what we just learned with the whales.
The hypothesis there is what's important is that post-reproductive females play an important role in the survival of their grandoffspring.
There's something that makes a lot of, I'll just say as a person with a 2-year-old child, like, makes a lot of sense to me. Like, you know, like my mother is just like incredibly helpful and useful. I mean, that's data point of one. It's not scientific, but we feel how this is like makes some amount of sense to be true.
Yes. Yeah.
So this hypothesis is just like your evolutionary purpose is to be a mom, even if you are no longer being a mom.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of the cultural takeaway. That's like what most of us think of, if you've ever heard of this before.
Mm-hmm.
But when you look at the whales, it goes way beyond that. Like the older killer whale female, she's actually kind of running the show.
I mean, it was clear that Granny was the one in charge. The matriarch of all matriarchs.
They play diplomat or keeper of the peace, especially with the younger male whales.
Females, especially post-reproductive females, are intervening in the lives of their adult sons, making sure that they're not roughhousing enough to get injured.
But also they're like hunter-in-chief,
leading the pod to find food to feed everybody.
Granny and her family have basically always exclusively eaten salmon.
But those salmon are really hard to find now because they've been hunted by humans.
But Granny, with her 11-pound, super-intelligent brain, she can remember things from, like, 25 years ago.
Yeah, you know, 25 years ago, at this time of year, there was a bunch of salmon that did go up this random little tributary halfway up the coast.
And the scientists could, like, literally see this play out as they were watching the whales on these hunts.
Granny would just start slapping her tail on the water, and, like, all the whales would go, like, whoop, Granny's calling. We're going to go in the direction that she wants us all to go. That was something that we used to get to see quite often.
And even after she spent
45 minutes or even an hour trying to catch a fish, you know, continuing, even though she was most assuredly hungry herself.
Giles said she would see her
bite the fish in half or sometimes even in thirds and have family members come over to grab that fish.
So the postmenopausal female whales, they might not be adding more of their genes to the gene pool, but
they're not sitting around filing their nails and watching daytime soap operas.
They're, like, totally crucial to the survival of the group.
These orca females are the repositories for ecological wisdom. They're keeping their hunting community alive.
Does it make you think about your experience as a woman? I mean, whenever I ask scientists this question, they're like, don't ask this question. So, but I guess, did, like, looking the orca in the eye and thinking about Granny change anything for you?
I probably shouldn't answer this question, but I will.
Answer.
I'll give you an honest answer, because I did. I felt incredibly moved by them. I really did. Mm-hmm. I was really pleased that I made the effort and I went there and I spent time with Dr. Giles and, you know, understanding how evolution had granted these females these long lives with such purpose made me think differently about my loss of fertility. And I found the idea that my value now was in my wisdom and my brain and the things that I can teach other people, really empowering. As opposed to feeling like you're a grey puddle that's, you know, decreasing relevance in the world and, you know, it's the opposite. You know, in every way, I was like, be more orca.
Yeah.
Plus the fact that the older females are having tons of sex.
I mean, that sounds great.
Right.
I love the idea of, like, being an orca. But there is something in me that, like, just sort of fundamentally chafes at the idea that I have to be useful in some way. Like, whether that's, like, being a caretaker or being, like, hunter in chief.
Right.
Like, it's like I always have to prove my worth.
Well,
if I'm not there to have babies.
I think you'll be kind of happy to hear that, you know, that's not the only idea that science has about menopause. When we come back from break, I'm going to tell you about another animal that's, I don't know, I think you might like this one.
Radiolab is supported by BetterHelp, committed to helping clients with issues ranging from relationship challenges and goal setting to grief and depression. Learn more at betterhelp.com/public. Radiolab is supported by Progressive Insurance. From the moment car insurance is quoted to the moment it's purchased, drivers can discover a variety of ways to stay protected. More at progressive.com.
Support for KQED comes from European Sleepworks, the store that bases its design and materials on research factors affecting sleep, including comfort and support, humidity levels, and ease of breathing. Details online about their mattresses and bedding at sleepworks.com. Support for KQED's car donation program comes from local Kia dealers. Announcing the Season of New Traditions event going on now at local Kia dealers, offering a selection of SUVs, sedans, and hybrids. More info at kia.com.
Covering the military is Tom Bowman's job, but when the Defense Department asked him to sign a pledge that would restrict his journalism, he turned in the press pass he's had for nearly 30 years. That hasn't stopped him, though.
You going to try to do that to us? We're going to find a way to get the information for the American people, period.
How NPR's Pentagon correspondent still reports, even after being barred from the building, on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered coming up at 5 o'clock this afternoon. Did you know that making a meaningful gift to KQED can be as easy as writing our name? When passed on to heirs, IRAs and 401ks can incur significant income and estate taxes. Naming KQED as beneficiary avoids these taxes and helps us build our endowment. To learn more, contact us at 415-553-2230 or email legacy@kqed.org. And we thank you. Time now 2:20.
All right, we're back for the second part of this episode.
Yep. Okay, so let's recap.
Love a recap.
We're talking about menopause and how it's super weird.
Totally weird.
We thought for a long time we're the only ones who did it. And then scientists learned about orcas.
Right.
And scientists started watching them and they sort of thought, oh, maybe we're solving this evolutionary puzzle.
Of like why we have menopause.
Of why we have menopause. But maybe not so much.
So let me unpack that.
So again, this is this guy, Kevin Langergraber.
We're really getting into the weeds here. For the
One important detail that I didn't mention before about Kevin is that every year for the past 25 years, Kevin has spent time living what he calls
chimp life.
Working on this thing called the Ngogo Chimpanzee Project.
Which is a long-term study of this one community of chimpanzees.
It's in southwestern Uganda.
Pretty much smack dab in the middle of Kibali National Park.
So picture like
huge, huge trees.
And a wide open forest floor.
Like an open park.
Where every single day,
get up in the morning, have your breakfast and your coffee. The sun is just starting to come up. That's when you want to leave. And go find the chimps.
And then he spends the rest of his day just watching them.
Basically, you're writing down what they do.
They're grooming, they're hunting, they're eating. So kind of right from the beginning of his time there, Kevin started to notice something interesting about the older female chimps.
Okay.
Like Garbo, for example.
She's an old-timey silent movie character.
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
This female who now is about 72 years old.
No way. 72? That's like my mom's age.
Yeah. Kevin's actually known Garbo from the very beginning, since she was about 50.
Okay.
At which point,
she already had adult kids.
But for the last 25 years, he's never seen her have a baby.
But here's the thing, you know, post-reproductive individuals, they exist, you know. There's always like the occasional old female who doesn't reproduce anymore.
But the thing Kevin wanted to figure out was like, is Garbo an anomaly? Or is this something that's happening to more chimps than just her?
Exactly.
And to get to the bottom of that, he had to collect
biological samples.
Okay, back to poop.
No, not poop. Pee.
Yeah.
Urine.
Urine.
No shade to poop samples, obviously.
Urine collection is actually easier than fecal sample collection because they pee a lot more than they poo.
I don't know about easy, though, because what Kevin has to do is
You get a stick from the forest. Picture a stick that's about 3 feet long.
And it looks kind of like a Y.
Sort of like a weird pitchfork or something.
Okay. And he puts a little plastic bag on the end of the Y.
And then when the chimps are up in a tree, they're peeing down on you, and you stick your stick out, you know, away from you so that you don't collect too much pee yourself, you know, on your head and stuff.
And you get the stream of pee to connect with your stick.
And then it fills up that bag. This is highbrow science.
Now, these pee samples, they're sort of like the whale poop. They can tell you a lot about what's happening in the bodies of individual chimps, like Garbo, for example.
You're just waiting for Garbo to pee. And then when she does, you'd better be ready.
So when Kevin analyzed her samples and the samples of the other older female chimps,
we found, you know, smoking gun sort of level of signs that we rarely get.
Because looking at the levels of reproductive hormones,
it was really just easy to tell that,
yep, female chimps,
Garbo and these other old females,
go through menopause.
Yes.
And I mean like they go through menopause. It's very similar to the human experience.
Ooh.
Or at least we think it is. Kevin was very careful to mention that, like, I can't speak to hot flashes.
No.
Right. Like, I can't speak to some of the physical symptoms or like the emotional swings.
Right.
But like, there's a hormone cessation.
Right. And that cessation, it's pretty similar to the pattern in humans. It's like a ramping down, basically.
Wow.
And after that, they just keep on living their lives for decades sometimes. Just like humans and just like the whales.
And then there were three.
Yeah, exactly. Well, sort of. actually, when they did all that orca research, they actually found out that there were a handful of other whales that are really similar to orcas that also go through menopause. So like narwhals.
Narwhals?
Yeah. But chimps are the third major animal group we know of that experience this long life after menopause.
Is Garbo also scratching her head, asking what life is for after menopause?
No, she's not.
But Kevin definitely is.
Let's think about it.
Okay, so I'm going to like paint you a picture of what Garbo's life is like.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so before she stopped having babies, she had three sons.
Monk, Richmond, and Hutcherson.
By the way, why don't they name them like Steve or something?
It feels very like old money.
I know, like who came up with it? Okay, so Monk and Richmond actually aren't alive anymore, but let's just like imagine a time when they all were alive. Because like, long story short, a big part of Garbo's day is hanging out with her sons.
She had like, you know, a good relationship with both Hutcherson and Richmond.
What about Monk?
No, Monk, she hated Monk.
Oh.
Like, they didn't even know they were related until they did the genetic testing, and they were like, oh, I guess she had three sons, not just two.
Scandal.
Yeah. Dang, Garbo.
Dang, Garbo.
Anyway, so all day, Garbo, Hutcherson, and Richmond would be together.
Richmond and Hutcherson would groom Garbo a lot.
Like kind of running their fingers through her hair and picking out bugs and like scratching her little back.
Love it.
And she would totally bliss out.
Like zone out in this really zen-like state. It's like, you know, I'm bald now, but I remember when I used to go to the hairdresser and get my hair cut. And you could feel like the hairdresser running their hands through your scalp. Mm-hmm. I would just zone out and ah.
Also, Richmond and Hutcherson would bring food to Garbo.
You know, share meat with Garbo.
Monkey meat.
Chimps eat monkey meats?
Yeah. It's a chimp delicacy. Mm. They love a monkey meat.
Okay.
In the movie version of this, they would bring it to her on like a silver platter and honor her.
I mean, that's what's happening in my head. So does that mean she doesn't have to hunt for herself?
Right. Also,
if someone would be aggressive to Garbo, often, you know, Richmond and Hutcherson would like chase them off, you know, protecting their mother.
Uh-huh.
And that's it. That's all that Garbo does. So like kind of notice here what you're not hearing.
No real grandmothering behavior.
So Garbo is not making Christmas cookies for her grandchildren.
No, she's not.
She's not doing anything toward the youth.
Or really towards anyone.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, she's not super helpful.
Huh. God, that's the dream. I want to be old lady chimp.
Yeah. And so because
the grandmother hypothesis doesn't seem to apply to chimps.
Kevin and a bunch of the other scientists started looking into like, what is going on here?
Yeah, the second most prominent hypothesis is called this reproductive conflict hypothesis.
The reproductive conflict hypothesis.
I love that we've gone from like the grandmother hypothesis, which feels so loving, to
reproductive conflict. Well, bear with me because in some ways it's maybe the opposite, or it's maybe not quite what you think it's going to be.
I love that. Go.
Okay. And the theory itself is like a little bit convoluted, but
okay.
The big idea is that there's a sort of subtle evolutionary calculation hidden in the way chimpanzee females set up their families.
In chimpanzees, males stay in their group for their whole lives.
But the females, the daughters, when they hit puberty, they leave their family group to join another one.
The general reason for this is like avoid inbreeding, right?
Right.
So think of this. Think of it, you're a female chimp. You're born in one group.
Then you hit like 12 or 13.
Mm-hmm.
You disperse to a new group where you want to start having kids.
When you first get into that new family, you're not related to anybody around you. You don't share genes with anyone.
But as you have your first kid, let's say you have a male.
Then you have one family member, your son, who does have your genes.
It eventually grows up. It has its own kids.
Those kids have your genes.
So you're just getting more related to group members.
As you grow into an older female chimp.
Okay.
So now to zoom out a little bit.
Now here's the, why is it called the reproductive conflict hypothesis?
If you look at the larger group that the chimp female is part of.
There's a limited amount of resources. And if you have a kid, that means that some other female in your group can't have a kid.
Yeah, it's just how basic ecology works.
Right.
Reproduction is a zero-sum game. So there's reproductive conflict between females.
And so if you're this older female chimp and you're looking around, maybe there are like new young females that have just joined your family. And you're like,
who's going to have the next kid? Me or this young female?
Mm-hmm.
If this young female has this kid, who's she going to have it with? Well, it could be my son that has the kid with this young female, right?
And my genes could get passed down that way.
So I'm going to get some indirect fitness benefits through this young female's reproduction.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
on the other hand,
can the young female say the same thing about the reproduction of this old female? No, she shares no genes with the hypothetical offspring of this old female.
So as the evolutionary math would have it,
old females are predicted to sort of cede these reproductive opportunities to the young females and stop reproducing.
Oh, so it's like Garbo and other older female chimps can contribute to the group and get a benefit themselves just by bowing out and doing their own thing.
Right.
That's cool.
Yeah, that makes sense, right? Good theory.
Good theory.
But just like the grandmother hypothesis, it's not a perfect fit.
Why?
Well, apparently, so this gets kind of like mathy and nitpicky, but Kevin says that the benefits of these older females bowing out, they like don't quite make up for the fact that they're like living these long, luxurious post-reproductive lives, like painting their nails and eating monkey meat. So it like maybe doesn't quite work.
Okay. Damn it. So is Kevin about to swoop in and be like, I've got my own hypothesis?
No, I do not.
Oh, what?
I do not.
Wait, so I'm just left hanging?
Right. And left with the, I don't know, just the magic and wonder of this world, right?
There's like not a grand universal theory of post-reproductive females.
Okay.
And it's still just like a real open question of why we or orcas or chimps live this long post-reproductive life.
Right. I mean, honestly, there's a part of me that's like, thank God, because if we had actually found an answer, it would have felt so prescriptive. I don't know. It makes me feel like it would have been kind of sad.
I agree. I mean, I think it would be kind of limiting. And I think the thing is, one of the things I've loved about this reporting process of the story isn't really learning the theories, which are kind of confusing in a lot of ways, but actually learning about these specific animals like Granny and Garbo and just imagining their lives. Like, what do they do during that time?
Yeah.
And I feel like I've gotten to a point in my reporting where I'm much more interested in the what they're doing than the why does this happen? If that makes any sense.
Mm.
And at some point, I also remembered that there is, of course, that third animal that goes through menopause and has a long post-reproductive life.
Everyone feels good, strong.
Yes.
And so I called up one of them.
Yes.
My name is Caroline Paul, and I'm a writer. And my expertise is that I am postmenopausal. I'm 61 years old.
I mean, to be fair, Caroline also wrote an entire book that's basically a study of how women live their lives after menopause.
Called Tough Broad, From Boogie Boarding to Wing Walking, How Outdoor Adventure Improves Our Lives as We Age.
And so I went to her and I asked her, like, okay, there's Granny, there's Garbo, now tell me about Caroline.
I love that.
You know, I think when I was young, I was really interested in metrics. So I wanted to be the first.
She's specifically this like very adventure-y kind of lady.
Sometimes I was the first down a river. I was the first to mountain bike through the Bolivian Andes.
I'm like, Heather just got her driver's license.
Yeah, I didn't just get it, but I am learning how to drive alone on the road. So, you know, everyone's in a different moment of their life.
To each their own adventure.
Anyway, back to Caroline. When she started to have menopause symptoms, or really perimenopause symptoms,
it was almost like someone had like killed your dog and given you a weird acid drug at the same time for extended periods.
Like, in what sense is that the case?
I was crying all the time and eating at weird hours of the night. The other thing that kept happening is that I would go to parties and I wouldn't remember anybody's face.
Whoa.
And all of this went on for like,
I think it was like 4.5 years.
Jeez.
But this all kind of tracked with what she was expecting to happen, because she, like kind of all of us, had heard that this time in her life would be pretty brutal.
Right. The only thing you hear, it feels like, is how dreadful it will be.
Right.
But I just remember around 57 suddenly realizing that I felt really different.
She felt like a lot calmer and clearer.
There was no more sudden crying jags. I remembered everybody's name, everybody's face.
And that's when she realized,
oh, now I'm in menopause.
And for this part of her life, she told me really the only messaging she was getting is what, like, not to do.
Narrowing life, not opening it up.
Because women, as they get older, are getting told things like,
we have to watch our bones. We have to watch our brain. Our cognitive health is on decline. We're told that as we age, we're losing losing things.
But beyond that, she kind of didn't have a roadmap.
For menopausal women, women over 50, 60, we don't have a script anymore. There's a big gray area.
She felt kind of lost. Meanwhile, men her age, everywhere they look, they have tons of scripts, tons of icons.
I mean, Harrison Ford is still running through tombs. Tom Cruise is jumping off some high building somewhere.
And she was like, why can't we have that? So she set out to write this book, which became
the quest to understand whether I should have outdoor adventure in my life.
And she met all these different women in their 60s and 70s and 80s that were doing like totally bad stuff.
From base jumping as a grandmother to sea kayaking to BMX bike racing.
These are not women who are worried about bones breaking.
Not at all. And like, well, that's great. And I'm all for it. But, you know, as somebody who's maybe not the most physically adventurous person, I also really appreciated some of the other stories she told me about women who were going on quieter but still very meaningful adventures.
I went bird watching with someone in a wheelchair.
And she talked to this kind of amazing woman who learned how to swim in her 60s.
Oh, cool.
And it was very scary for her, but she still pushed herself to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So and what she found was like not just a bunch of role models for her,
yeah,
but she also found that that for a lot of these women,
instead of closing down their life, had found new aspects of themselves.
Finding new possibilities for their life, and they kind of had these new capacities for awe and wonder and bravery that they had never tapped into before.
Yeah, I mean, I think that this is a time of great exploration that we should be grabbing hold of. There are new permutations and very valuable ones of us as we age.
It's like the minute hypothesis is just to flip the script or something. That no script is the script.
Yeah, right, exactly.
And I wonder if one of the sort of uses of us, if we're going to be that, let's say, scientific about it, is simply to show the younger generation that life is going to get better. I have seen personally that when young people see how our lives are at this age, I think all that is of great value. So we don't really have to put a lot of work into that. We can just go and be our best selves. We should be sitting in that tree, being fed delectable meats, and doing whatever we want.
Thank you, Heather.
You too, Molly.
Good luck on your...
On my driving journey?
Not on the driving journey, the menopause journey.
Oh, yeah, right. Our menopause
You've
journey,
got some time.
Hopefully.
Yeah, maybe we'll be holding hands and base jumping together.
I don't think so. Maybe we'll just... Okay. Let's go bird watching.
Okay.
Radiolab is supported by Made in Cookware, who now offer a carbon steel outdoor grill with charcoal or hardwood options. This carbon steel grill aims to provide restaurant quality performance wherever it is used. More at madeincookware.com.
Radiolab is supported by Seed.com. Seed's DS01 is a 24-strain, 2-in-1 probiotic and prebiotic engineered to survive digestion, support healthy regularity, and promote whole body health. Learn more at SEED.com/public.
Support for KQED comes from Landmark College, offering academic executive function and social coaching support for neurodivergent individuals at the Bay Area Success Center. Learn more at landmark.edu/successcenter. And support comes from Sierra Nevada Brewing Company, where a commitment to pure ingredients and sustainable brewing meet a legacy of craft since 1980. Sierra Nevada, taste what matters. Please drink responsibly.
Activists sailed towards Gaza to deliver aid. They ended up in an Israeli prison instead.
You have no control, you have no information, and you have no rights. They can do whatever they want to you.
On the next Reveal.
Reveal every Saturday afternoon at 4 with your host, Al Lutzen. Before that, it's Freakonomics Radio at 3.
I'm Stephen Dubner. On the next Freakonomics Radio, for decades, private equity has delivered big returns to institutional and ultra-wealthy investors.
Those funds beat the S&P 500, which is just remarkable.
But now, private equity is opening to retail investors. Will this be a gold rush or maybe fool's gold?
I think the party is over in the private markets.
That's next time on Freakonomics Radio.
Radio Lab for another 20 minutes, and then Freakonomics Radio comes your way at 3, all ahead here on KQED News.
Hey, this is Radio Lab. I'm Molly Webster. And in the first part of the show, we talked about menopause. But now I want to shift gears and talk about something that happens sort of on the road to menopause, which is that slowly, in the years before menopause, a woman's fertility starts to decline. And I don't know if you've heard about this, but my friends and I kept hearing about this moment called a fertility cliff, which is kind of a downward turn in fertility that's so sharp, even though you're years away from menopause, like the chance of you getting pregnant is next to nil. And so my question was, is this cliff we're all hearing about true? So I did some reporting on this for a live event that was part of a series about human reproduction that I did for Radiolab. And so we're going to play a part of that live event for you now, the part that takes on the fertility cliff. Here we go.
Hello, hello. How's everybody doing? All right. We're so excited that you guys are here tonight. My name is Jad. I host Radiolab and More Perfect. And I will now introduce a rising star at Radiolab and in podcasting and at WNYC and on planet Earth. Welcome, Molly Webster.
Planet Earth might have been a bit bold, I will just say. thank you for coming. This is amazing. Hi, everyone. Okay, so why are we all here? When I started reporting on the series, one of the first things I did was I just jumped on the phone with a lot of people. People like everyone in this room. I was like trying to hit like different age groups. I wanted 18-year-olds. I wanted like 80-year-olds. I was calling all my friends back in the Midwest like, hey, I haven't visited in a while, but if you could just tell me your thoughts on reproduction, like what's it like in the Midwest? And then I was very, you know, I was like, oh, someone's, you know, 20 and married in Colorado? Yes, I'll call you too. And I was basically just calling and saying, when I say the word reproduction, like what do you do? Like what do you think? Are you like, oh, God, or, you know, interested, not interested, babies, anything more than babies? One guy talked to me about hip-hop, and I was like, I could go that way, probably won't. And so there were a lot of, like, very random conversations. And one of the things that came up in those conversations was a number. The number was 35. It took me a while to sort of notice the pattern, but I realized that everyone was bringing it up in different ways. It was like, oh, I don't know if there's not that much time left. Or, you know, women would be like, I'm drying up. My biological clock, it's ticking. There was this idea that just kept coming up over and over again. The idea that at the age of 35, your fertility vanishes if you're a woman. It just goes up in smoke.
Like, in every relationship that I'm in, I feel like it's like this countdown clock in the back of my mind. You know, and so I feel like I experience time differently.
And Bianca, the young woman on the phone here, she wasn't the only one who told us about this feeling. It came up in another conversation that we had with this woman named Chloe. She said she really, really wanted to have kids. She was in a relationship. She and her partner got along great. Partner wasn't sure she wanted to have kids. And so on her 30th birthday, Chloe's dad sent her an email where he basically said, like, get on it.
The biological clock keeps ticking, especially if you want to have several kids. You don't want to split up with your partner because they've done nothing wrong, but the biological clock, dot, dot, dot.
Thanks, Dad. It's very helpful on my birthday. And to add flame to the fire, I talked to another woman who saw 35 as such a deadline, she decided that she was going to have a kid by herself when she was 34. She wasn't going to wait. And she told me that the doctors categorized her in a way that really surprised her.
The minute you're 35, you're considered a geriatric mother. It's a condition that is written on, it was written on my birth chart because I was due 2 weeks after turning 35.
And so I kept thinking as I was like hearing all the stuff, I was like, I'm not freaking out about this stuff, but like, should I be freaking out about this stuff?
And then last October, I was on the phone with this sort of bigwig doctor in St. Louis. And the minute we got on the phone, the first thing he asked me was how old I was. I said I was 34. And he said, you need to get on a plane and fly out here, and we need to freeze those eggs. And then I thought, F off. And then I thought, maybe when the series is done. And then I thought, you know, maybe I should be taking this all a little bit more seriously and actually look into this whole, like, reproductive cliff thing. So, started reading a lot of scientific articles, watching YouTube, and I pretty quickly found what seemed to be the culprit of the cliff. So the X-axis is age.
Okay, so I need you to put on sort of your visualization cap, because we're going to go through a few graphs in this story. And for this one, it is a line graph.
It goes 20 to 45. And the Y, the vertical line, is something called fecundability, which is the chance a couple will get pregnant after 1 month of trying. And this is what the graph looked like.
The shape of the graph is a line that goes pretty straight up from puberty. It stays flat until the age of 33, and then it turns and goes pretty steeply down until it hits zero. Here's me describing it on stage as an animation of it unfolded.
It goes... and then there's like a fireball at the end. So this is from a journal called Human Reproduction. It was published in 2004, and that is a cliff if I've ever seen one. And I think another thing that I wanted to note is that on this graph, 33 is the age where you actually should start freaking out. 35, you're already done. But there's one tiny caveat, and that is that the data behind this graph is crap. This data is based on French peasants from the 1700s. And you may ask, why them out of everybody? And the idea is that when they're doing fertility studies, they want, ideally, they say, populations of humans that have never used birth control. So people that are like pure from artificial hormones. And their idea was that these French peasants were the way to go. And so this came up, you might have seen this, it got written about in like a lot of different magazines, and it was the data being used to terrify women. And then so I just say, you know what, like I reject this cliff, because I'm done with it. And so at this point, I thought maybe I should stop watching YouTube and actually like call someone on the phone. And so I called an epidemiologist from Boston. Her name is Lauren Weiss, and she studies fertility.
I know where the cliff came from. There was a very pivotal.
You do?
Oh yeah.
Oh
there
my God!
Was...
Tell me about the cliff.
So the cliff, I'm pretty sure, came from this review paper written by Brockmans.
Who is this Brockman guy, and why does he get to draw a cliff on my fertility?
He's a very famous reproductive endocrinologist.
So after we got off the call, Lauren sent me the paper she was thinking about. This one is a study of recent people, and it has the same like axes. It's 20 to 40 is age on the bottom, and then on the side is your chance of pregnancy. And it goes...
And so this line graph, it starts high, and as it moves right, it continues just flat and unchanging. And then at some point, that line turns downward, and it arcs to the bottom of the graph, kind of like a skateboard ramp.
And then it's like a little, like a water slide at the end. And I thought, oh, that looks like, it's kind of like a mesa. That's like a version of a cliff. And so then I thought, well, you know, maybe this graph, I'm reacting pretty emotionally to it. So I was like, okay, this one.
And so what you see on stage is I highlight that the downward turn on the graph happens at the age of 31.
31, my friends. We should have had this event 4 years ago. Sigh. But Lauren says it's not really based on great data either. Is it based on more peasants? No, I'm glad you asked. It is based on recent people, but it's all people that were at fertility clinics for fertility issues. So one could say it's a bit of a compromised data set. It's not really representative of everyone. So back to where we started, begs the question, what happens if you actually look at an entire population or like a good cross-section of the population? And Lauren, the scientist who I was talking to, did actually do that. So in 2007, she launched a study with almost 3,000 Danish women who were trying to get pregnant.
We follow them forward in time for 12 months or until they get pregnant, whichever comes first.
And when you look at their data, this is what you see.
So this graph looks basically like a gently sloped hill. The line starts halfway up. It goes up, actually, a little bit more, and then it curves gently down, arcing to the bottom.
Ooh, oh, oh, there we go. There with that.
Fertility doesn't look like a cliff at all.
I feel good about that. Does anybody else? All right. On this one, your fertility goes up for a little while. Right? 30. It goes up till you're 30. And then when you're 35, you're actually just below the fertility you had when you were 20, which seems like that seems great. So I thought, all right, I'm reacting very emotionally. Tell me some numbers. And so they said for 20 to 24-year-olds, after 1 year of trying and having regular sex, which is actually like a technical term, so take that as you will, but I won't judge you, the chance of being pregnant...
78%.
Okay.
And if you're age 35 to 40, that percentage is 72%.
That feels like, oh, I'll take those odds.
Yeah.
So if you're in the 35 to 40-year-old age group here, as I am, that means you have a 3 out of 4 chance of getting pregnant. And you have to keep in mind, these are rough estimates. So obviously fertility is affected by age, but it's not the only thing that's affected by age. Miscarriage rates go up as you get older. Down syndrome rates also go up. So treat these like ballpark figures for now, but just... in your mind, remember, 72% for 35 to 40-year-olds. And so to me, this graph, it's like less cliff, more like English countryside. Like I will go get a pint on my way to pregnancy. This one actually made me want to call all those people we heard earlier on the phone and be like, psst, send this to your dad, right? But...
now, I should say that our latest research from the North American study shows stronger effects.
Not so fast, Webster. Not so fast. After the Denmark study, Lauren and her team were like,
well, you know, Denmark is cool, but what about other countries?
So they start the same study in U.S. and Canada.
Now, this graph, as it unfolded on stage, was a real humzinger. It started high on the left, and then it immediately begins to descend. It slopes down gently. There's a bit of a bump where it regains some height, and then it turns downward, this time just more steeply dropping to the bottom.
Oh, that's a tricky one. Expected something else. This one, I felt sadder when I looked at it. I felt like this is less English countryside, more like a mountain biking championship sponsored by Red Bull was kind of my feeling on this one. And this is what Lauren said.
It is steep. It's something you wouldn't want to take your kid on for a walk. You would want to wear a helmet and some protective equipment.
And do you think the different results is different parts of the globe? So like they're both truly representative of the area they're in, or like that one is wrong and it's really a line and not an uphill and then a downhill?
Oh, that is such a good question, Molly, and I don't know the answer to it.
It could be differences in diet and the environment and smoking. It could be just all that bike riding in Denmark. Who knows?
We all just need to go to Denmark.
Exactly.
Honestly, it seems like I should have been having sex in Denmark when I was 30.
Exactly. That is the take-home message of
our
study.
I should not have been. And it was very good that I was in North America, depending on what you want your outcome to be.
Exactly. So the Danish study, I think, is a happier, cheerier study.
And it's true. If you look at the numbers for the North American study, they are lower. So if you're in the 37 to 39-year-old age range and you have sex, again, regularly for 1 year, you have a 67% chance at conception. Past 40, it drops to 55. So take that in. There are three things I took away from talking to Lauren. First, it's pretty obvious that there is no cliff. As another biologist I spoke with said, like, nothing in biology is a cliff, right? It's all just like a gradual change. It's like a gradual decline with age. And in a way, there's something about it being gradual. It kind of lets you choose to freak out where you want to freak out. The second thing I thought about with Lauren was that, you know, obviously it's different for everybody, and these are just really big studies, and it's just averages, right? And the third thing was, like, even in the North American study, at like 40, 42, you still land at 50%. So it's not zero, which to me, I was like, hey, 50-50, that's not bad, right? But there was one part of the conversation with Lauren that made me think about 35 in kind of a different way. It started when she reminded me that there is, as much as I was happy about the 50-50, actually a biological deadline. What is the actual end?
Oh, the average age at menopause is 50 in the United States.
And so maybe the thing that's going on for a lot of people is it's not so much a cliff at 35, rather 35 is an age where sort of the end comes into focus. And as I was thinking more and more about the phone conversations I was having, I realized, like, oh, this was playing out for everybody. Like, this is biology, but the people who were, like, wondering about their careers and their homes and their parents, like, they were all sort of having the same, like, moment where they're like, oh, there's something happening here where I feel something in front of me, like, in the way I never had before. It's like there's, like, this, like, little sliver of possibility before you all come back here in 5 years when you're 40 and we do this again. Thank you so much. So this event, which was called 30-something, happened live on stage in 2018. So it felt like it was time to maybe update the numbers. So I called Lauren back a few weeks ago, and she said to me that based on sort of a larger data pool, now what they're seeing is just kind of minor adjustments. But if you're in the 37 to 39-year-old range and you have sex regularly for 1 year, you have a 66% chance at conception. And after 40, it drops to 51%. Now, this is unpublished data, but if you look at this mapped on a graph, it doesn't really change the original shape of the graph, as you heard me describe it in the episode. Also, the term geriatric pregnancy, you may now hear it as advanced maternal age, and they picked 35 as a cutoff because it was linked to an evidence of decline in fertility and also concern in increased risks for genetic abnormalities. So it doesn't all have to do with the fertility cliff, but it's often linked in conversation. Okay, that does it for me. I would like to thank researcher Lauren Wise. She's an epidemiologist at Boston University. Thank you for crunching the numbers. I also want to thank everyone who talked to me on the phone in preparation for this live event, including the voices featured on this episode, Bianca, Chloe, and Emily. Thank you. And lastly, Diane Kelly fact-checked this story, and I want to thank Pat Walters, Rachel Cusick, and Jat Abumrad for editing and producing the live event. If you want more on reproduction, go check out our series. I hosted, reported, and produced it with Rachel and Pat. It is called Gonads, and it's featured on our website. Go to radiolab.org, search series,
And while you're there, you should also just sign up for the newsletter. Okay? Thanks so much for listening. I'm Molly Webster, and this is Radiolab.
Freakonomics Radio is coming up next, along with an NPR news update and KQED news as well. Support for KQED comes from Eric and Winnie Schmidt, whose philanthropy works to create a healthy, resilient, secure world for all on the web at theschmidt.org. Let's take a quick look at traffic. Starting in Sunnyvale, here's Steve Herrera.
Good afternoon, Beth. I'm seeing lots of stopped traffic in Sunnyvale. Northbound 85 just before Fremont Avenue, a two-vehicle fender bender is impacting the right lane. A problem on the upper deck of the Bay Bridge at Treasure Island. Somebody broke down in the center to fight, and traffic is slammed attempting to leave San Francisco eastbound Skyway from 101 to the lower deck. Steve Herrera for KQED.
Well, thank you so much, Steve. Traffic support comes from Murphy McKenna Construction, custom home builders. Chilly today, temperatures getting into the upper 50s to low 60s with hazy sunshine and some clouds as well. Same for tomorrow.